50 years of Mid-Continent Public Library, and this is a big deal for us and a big deal for the community. And library service and the role of the library in the community has changed so dramatically in 50 years, not just in Mid-Continent, but nationwide. What have you seen in terms of the shape of how we do business with our public, and how has it evolved, and I guess where do you see it going in the future?
There's certainly two ways to answer that. One sort of a really sort of macro level, and one sort of a micro level. Macro level being, you know, how different are libraries in general today than they were 50 years ago? Then how different is Mid-Continent? Sort of a micro level question. Then are the types of services that Mid-Continent does today versus 50 years ago. And macro level, I think the real big difference in libraries is that I think things were more universal back 50 years ago, that really it was a matter of volume more than a matter of anything else. One of the things that I've mentioned to people before is that the delivery channels for information pretty much stayed the same with minor tweaks, you know, from about Gutenberg until the internet. I mean, there was the invention of the paperback, the mass market paperback, which really made a big difference in terms of being able to easily and cheaply disseminate information and books became cheaper to print as raw materials became easier to get. But for the most part, the methods were the same. And so if you wanted to do a research paper, when I was a kid, the methods for doing a research paper were the same as they were when my dad was a kid. And when, you know, his dad was a kid, and they all grew up in cities. So, I mean, that was, you know, all pretty easy for them in terms of that. I mean, even just going to the Truman Library and reading how Harry Truman used the Independence Library, which was the library that was part of the school district at that particular time. When you read his accounts of that, it sounds not that different from when I used to use the library in the 1980s and in the early 1990s. So I think if you go back 50 years ago, what you would find is that as suburbanization was occurring, you found more libraries showing up in areas where there previously wasn't a library service, more concrete libraries, more library buildings, where previously it may have only been served with a bookmobile or a library by mail program or something like that. You know, but the difference between, say, you know, a library at, you know, in terms of Mid-Continent, a library at Buckner versus a library at Antioch was just a matter of volume. One was bigger than the other. One was open more hours than the other. But in terms of service, it was really about the same. And really, I think that was the same throughout most of the country as well, until you started getting into the 1970s. And I think what you started seeing in the 1970s and 1980s is urban libraries in particular began to take on a more of a social service component, because there was different types of need. It wasn't really need to read or need to learn to read. I mean, there were more basic sort of like base level Maslow, you know, food and shelter issues that libraries in some cases began to start working with. And so you started seeing that in the urban areas. And as some of those problems have been moving out into the suburban first ring suburbs, I think you're starting to see that out here as well. In fact, you know, when we did our Food for Fines program, I got a lot of thank you notes from the food pantries that received the benefits from that. But the person who came up and talked to me most about this was Doug Cowan, who is the director of the Community Services League in Independence. And he was talking a lot about the impact that this was making in the first ring suburbs of Independence, which, you know, in 1975 or 1965, Independence was still, it wasn't an affluent suburb, but it was still a well enough suburb. There really wasn't a homeless issue in Independence, or at least a perceived homeless issue in Independence in the 60s and the 70s. But now, I mean, there's a suburban poverty issue here. And so that's changing the way that we are approaching, I think, some of our services, that it's not about, well, there was an article that came out not too long ago that somebody was saying, they were making an economic argument that libraries, public libraries, should not be supported Because basically all public libraries are is a place where middle-class people go and buy books that are go and use books that they should be buying, but they're just too cheap to buy them themselves. So they make everybody else buy them for them. But to be completely honest, I mean, there's a lot of people who have that idea. If the purpose of the library is just to get Harry Potter books for middle-class kids who could otherwise afford them, and so they decide to use the library money for that and use their allowance to buy a video game, is that really fair? The problem with the argument is that it completely misses what libraries do. I think that we've been out of the book providing business as our exclusive domain for many years. I think even back when I was a kid using the libraries, that was a big part of what we did, but that's not what a big part of what every library did. And I think it's becoming less a part. I think the library is a place for collaboration and community, that it's a place that people come together to collaborate on new ideas, that people come to receive mentoring. I mean, if you go up to the Woodneath Library Center, any time after it opens, you'll find their collaboration rooms are full the entire time. And sometimes it's going to be people who are doing literacy training, like tutoring. Sometimes it's going to be homeschoolers. Sometimes it's going to be business people who are tutoring each other or teaching each other or coming up with new ideas. Sometimes it's going to be a high school group that's studying for something. It's going to be a myriad of different ideas, but that's what a library should be. A library needs to be something like that. And it's not just because it's the hip and trendy thing to do, because you could say, well, yeah, but they do all those things at a Starbucks too. And they do, or you can. But I actually spend a decent amount of time in Starbucks. This is probably no surprise to a lot of people. But one of the reasons why is because I have lots of meetings all over town. And like a lot of people who are business folks, you know, you've got 45 minutes. What are you going to do for 45 minutes? Well, there's a Starbucks nearby. I'll just go in and drink a cup of coffee for 30 minutes and then I'll go to my meeting. I mean, that's what a lot of folks do. And when I go to those Starbucks and I look around and I see what's happening, you really couldn't do something like a tutoring session there, because right in the middle, when you're trying to explain something, all of a sudden the milk foam starts going and making all kinds of noise, and they start grinding beans and making more noise. And then somebody cranks up the James Taylor and, you know, and it's just crazy. So, I mean, while you could do that at a commercial venue, first of all, they're always going to make you pay for something to go in and participate there, which is their prerogative. That's what they're supposed to do. Library for ongoing research and ongoing use is going to have a low threshold to entry. Basically, if you can come in and you can adhere to the conduct policy, you can be there. So that's one thing in one way that we're different. Secondly, although a library is not so quiet that you can hear a pin drop, and never really shouldn't be, and our buildings are not built to foster that sort of environment anyway, they never have been that way. But a library does offer a place where you can provide some level of contemplation. And hopefully, as we're able to move forward with our 10-year capital plan, we'll be able to build more of these small contemplative areas where people can sit down and study, collaborate, whatever it is they need to do. And so this becomes a huge win-win. Kids can be kids in a story time, and they can make as much noise as they want. But then there's still these rooms where people can tutor or do whatever it is that they need to do. And that's just in terms of the environment. I mean, we haven't even talked about things like, you know, the real information that we have in the library. It's not just the bestsellers that people are too cheap to buy their own bestsellers. I mean, there is information that we are providing small business startups that are allowing them to be successful and to add to our economy that, frankly, I don't know how else they'd get this information, or if they did get it, it would be at a considerable cost. Because we can pool our monies and we have economy of scale, we can do things that the individual consumer cannot do by themselves. And so that allows whether the individual consumer is a school child trying to, you know, reach to a higher rung in education, or a small business owner, or just somebody who wants to know how to build a deck without the deck falling down. I mean, it doesn't matter what it is. If people have that information need, we have the ability to provide quality information to people without making them do anything else other than having the interest in the information. So another thing that I think that it's going to be interesting for libraries in the future, and certainly for Mid-Continent, is our approach to literacy. Literacy has always been important in terms of libraries, that we support and foster literacy in different ways. As Mid-Continent was more of a suburban library and rural library, the way we best fostered literacy was to provide enough books for people that they could continue to read and continue to keep that skill up, whether it's a toddler or, you know, a farmer who is essentially snowbound and nothing to do because you can't be out in the fields working. So they have 20 books and they read through those. I found a lot of those folks up by like where my in-laws live in true farm country. In the winter, they read a lot because there's not a whole lot else to do. And, you know, they want to stay around the farm for whatever reason. And so, but we've moved away from that as being sort of our primary MO, our primary support for literacy. While we're still going to do that, and as I always say, I mean, the parents that got the memo and understand the importance of literacy and reading, they get that they can't buy enough picture books and board books to really build that relationship and build that skill in their child. And so we'll always have that part of the literacy. But when we look at what we're doing at Woodneath, you know, it literacy becomes much more than just reading. Literacy becomes about telling your story and writing your story and being changed and moved by other people's stories and having contemplation about what it is someone else's opinion and maybe your opinion changing just a fraction. I'm not saying that, you know, you go from black to white or red to blue. That's not at all what I'm saying, but just that you can change just a fraction, or you can have your opinion broadened by just a little bit, maybe even strengthen your own opinion because you've had a stronger contemplation of your ideas. All of that's literacy. And I think that's what we're going to end up doing at the Story Center, is that the Story Center, the exciting thing, or the thing that gets people really excited about the Story Center, is the fact that we may be providing stories. You know, that we may be printing books or having oral stories that people will be listening to. For me, that is exciting, but that really is just a happy outcome of the Story Center. The real purpose of the Story Center is to foster literacy in this new way so that people can be more thoughtful about their conversation, so that they can take new risks and learn new skills with what it is that they're doing. And, you know, maybe once in a blue moon, we'll come across a book that will sell 1,000 copies. And if we do that, that'll be really, really cool. But the real thing that we're going to try to do, foster literacy, build a community of people who can support each other around these ideas. I think that's really where, that's one of the places that we're going, that's going to be really different. That I really didn't envision for libraries when I first graduated from library school. And I'm sure there's a lot more. There's a whole lot more. We just have to be open to those ideas and try to figure out, you know, what is the idea? What is the community? What sort of headache are we solving for that community? And then what sort of program do they need to solve that headache? And once we find out what those are and implement that pretty simple strategy to doing it, I think we're going to be relevant for many years to come.
How do you think that in terms of what we do as a system, how much of it has become what we witness in the community and what our customers are giving us versus my imagination of libraries in the 1960s and 70s is a bunch of directors in a boardroom saying, we are going to build this branch and it's going to blah, 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 and that's how it's going to be. I feel like now it's more of a situation where we learn from our communities and our customers what it is that we should or should not be doing, and we base our business off of that. Do you feel like that's more of the model that we have now versus maybe when you started, was it more practical, like this is what libraries nationwide are doing? Do you think evolving like that is important, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask?
Yeah, the evolution is important. And I think that your description is pretty well on into how things worked traditionally. I think it was a little bit, there's a little bit more gray area I think that one of the things that happened in the old days is that people did tend to sort of look to the leadership, wait for the leadership to make decisions, and then for that to be pushed all the way down, mm-hmm. a sort of top-down management. And I think that's true not only in libraries, it's true in schools, it's true in lots of different environments. I think that we've tried to value a little bit more of the bottom up and a little bit more community engagement and a little bit more of that going on. We saw that a lot with our strategic plan. I mean, our first couple of strategic plans, we had a little bit of community engagement, but not a whole lot. The strategic plan that we're in right now involved querying everyone that we had a library card for, our email address with their library card. So we sent all of them questionnaires. We've also sent them follow-up questionnaires to find out how we're doing. It involved observation at every one of our branches and interviews at every one of our branches among the public. So, I mean, these are the types of things that people didn't do in the past. If you go through the archives, you'll find that Mr. Ferguson put together two really neat plans. I think it was called A Plan for the 80s and A Plan for the 90s, I think is what they were both called. And very top down. I mean, it's very clear to me what he was doing is he was laying this all out as his opinion. He gave it to the board adopted it, and then it got pushed down to the staff. That's the way it was done. And that was the way it was done in lots of different environments. It's not really unique to us in that respect. What I think is important though, is to do both. I mean, you have to connect with your public. You have to listen to what your public's saying. You have to respond to your public, but I don't want this to be taken the wrong way, but there are times when your public doesn't understand, that something that's a big deal for the library profession should actually be a big deal for the public. And they just don't get it. They just don't understand that it's a problem. And I'll give you an example. Because initially it's like, well, gosh, why wouldn't you just do what the public wants? The best example that I can come up with is personal privacy. Personal privacy is something that librarians and people in the library community have valued at very high level forever. I mean, you know, when I went to library school, even before I went to library school, we'd sit around, we'd have these debates about, you know, if a mom comes into the library and she wants to know what her kid has checked out, and you see that her kid has all these books checked out on child abuse, you know, do you tell the mom about the books that, mm-hmm. you know, and things like that. I mean, we've been having those discussions for decades in libraries. You know, the whole idea of people, you know, if someone who looks like a policeman, you can't tell if he's a policeman, but kind of looks like a policeman, could be a security guard, could be a private eye, you don't know, comes in and says, you know, this kid's been kidnapped. I need to know this person's home address right now. Do you look that up in the ILS and tell this person that information? I mean, we've had these sorts of concerns for years. And so shortly after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, a series of legislation goes through called the Patriot Act. And the Patriot Act did all kinds of changes to privacy and gave the government and different levels of government a lot more freedom to get information about people's personal habits and personal behaviors. Librarians were soundly against the Patriot Act as written. I mean, I think ALA came out and said there are several things that we could do that would make this a whole lot easier for us to swallow, but none of those got adopted. And we were basically told that, you know, we were just being afraid for no good reason. You know, fast forward to a couple of summers ago, and there's all of this concern about NSA spying, Edward Snowden, all of that. It's the same concern. It's the exact same thing. It's just that a lot of this was being intercepted by, you know, some of the most egregious stuff was stuff that was being intercepted by cell phone. But the things that people were upset about is the same thing that ALA said that they should be upset about their library use. And so from my perspective, you know, when all this stuff came out, my reaction was welcome to the party. I mean, this is what we've been talking about since 2001. Forget 2001. This is what we've been talking about since 1991. I mean, and 1901. I mean, libraries have always been very concerned about this issue. So there's going to be times every so often where a library is going to hold something and be more concerned about it than the public. And sometimes the public's going to say, I don't get it. But this is why you hire a librarian to run the library as opposed to running, you know, having a, you know, just somebody like your best friend who likes to read books run the library, because they don't, because people don't necessarily always understand those types of values. And it's tough, because sometimes you're going to want to hang on and cling on to an old value. And it really doesn't need to go away. I mean, like a traditional 1970s era reference service is something that needs to go away. I think reference service needs to be completely online. You know, there's some people who are still clinging on to this because they think, you know, people want this and they need it. They just don't realize they need it. But that's kind of different from what, from sort of the privacy issue that we were talking about before. So I think that once you determine that, you know, once you determine that there are certain things that we have to defend and we know are important for us to continue to do, you still have to be entrepreneurial. You still have to take a take a chance. And for me, this is what the article that I wrote with Diana Kander was about, is that you can sit around and you can do like a 1960s and a 1970s library director and sit in a room and say, I think this would be a good idea. And you just do it because you think it would be a good idea. But the problem is,
they pay me for
They pay me to make the decisions. And or even better, this is the one that you see a lot in libraries. Well, I use the library, you know, I work at the library, but I also use the library and I would like it if this happened. Well, you know, you're not exactly an unbiased arbiter at that right. particular point. But the thing that's important is to know that you have to take risks and you have to try some of these different things from time to time. So you use the model that she talks about in her book, where they come up with the idea, brainstorm, doesn't matter where the idea came from, just get great ideas. And then once you get great ideas, identify an audience that's going to use that idea. Because it doesn't matter what the idea is. No amount of marketing, no amount of publicity, no amount of tweaking is going to make people buy a service they don't want. Mm-hmm. So once you come up with the idea, identify the audience that's going to use that idea and determine how big of an issue it is in their life. Then once you determine that, it's a big issue and people will actually use this service if we put it out there, then you move forward with the service, as opposed to developing a whole service and then putting it out there. So it's and hoping. Yeah. And I mean, using educated guesses, lots of people do, but I mean, there's lots of examples where, I mean, I'm sure you can come up with examples at your own branches where you tried to do something. And you're like, gosh, I just knew this was going to work and it just didn't. And in many cases, it didn't, because we really didn't identify the audience that was going to use it. And I think if you do that, then you can come up with your own sort of central ideas, but then you wouldn't execute those central ideas until you identified your audience. So,
and we've kind of been touching on it the whole time with what Mid-Continent's been doing and how we've changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think, as we're celebrating our 50 years, what do you think kind of are the main kind of legacies, kind of cornerstones for Mid-Continent?
Mid-Continent is, I mean, it's a really important library system for me. I mean, I am younger than Mid-Continent Public Library, so I've never lived in a world where there wasn't a Mid-Continent Public Library. But, you know, for me, as I think back on it, I mean, some of my earliest memories of Mid-Continent, actually, this is one, my earliest memory of Mid-Continent is one that people helped me piece together. And it's because when the North Independence Branch used to be on Osage, I was telling somebody once this story that I always, when I was real little, the association that I had with the library was loud, noisy. And they're like, well, that's really weird, especially for like the 1960s and the 70s when people were still shushing librarians and stuff like that. And so we started deconstructing this memory a little bit, and we figured out what it was. Is at North Independence, it was you would walk into the building, in the old building, and you either went upstairs or downstairs. So you immediately walked in, there was a landing, and you either went upstairs or downstairs. And right to the side of the front door was a book drop. And it's actually Martha Lear that helped me piece this together. She was our old reference specialist for many years. And so if I was sitting in that doorway, like in a stroller with my mom, I would be sitting right next to that book drop. And so if somebody put a book in, it'd be pow, like that, you know, just really loud. And so And so we pieced that together. And I think because that is my earliest sort of association with libraries, I have a weird association. I mean, most people say library quiet. I said, you know, my association was library loud. Mm-hmm. And as weird as that was, it kind of changed my approach, how we were going to approach the library and what it was going to mean for different people. I mean, for me, it also ended up meaning, you know, it's a place that I spent a lot of time when I was in high school because I was on the debate team. And so we were spent a lot of time in the basement, you know, researching and learning about current events and topics. And then it became, you know, became my career. It became something that was just generally extremely important to me personally. But I think for the larger community, Mid-Continent Public Library is something that, first of all, a lot of people don't realize how important or how great the library is. And actually, I've had a lot of people talk to me about that, you know, that they use the library, they grow up in the neighborhood, they use it, they go away, they come, and when they go away and they live somewhere else, they suddenly realize, hey, not every library is like our library. I mean, Mid-Continent Public Library, I think, is still one of the top 25 largest libraries in the United States. That is surprising to people. And it should be surprising to people because we don't really look or feel like one of the top 25 libraries in the United States. We still look and feel like we're someone's neighborhood library. And so this idea that we can combine, you know, sort of the friendliness and service that you would find in a small town library, but the breadth and depth of resources that you would find in one of the 25 largest libraries is something that is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to duplicate. And so that's a big legacy. I think another thing that's important is our not just willingness, but our positive feelings around resource sharing and general access. And that the idea is that in order to be a great library, it's not that you have to have everything in one place, but you have to be able to access anything you want, when you want it, how you want it, where you want it. And that goes all the way back. I mean, if you were to ask Jim Leathers or you talk to John Ferguson, I mean, John Ferguson used to always talk about the idea that Mid-Continent Public Library is one library with 24 doors. And then he said 25 doors after Lone Jack and then, 30 doors after, but the thing is that, I mean, that has been the vision forever. And I think we're finally there. I mean, where it doesn't matter if you're in Edgerton or Camden Point or at North Independence, you've got the same reference collection. You've got the same access to high tech. You've got any book that you want. If it's not on the shelf, we'll ship it to you. If it's not physically available, we'll download it for you. Same with the music. I mean, you know, well, first of all, we have music. We didn't have music for a long time in this library system. Same thing with videos. We didn't have a video collection, but now we do. And not just an entertainment video, but we all educational video. We've got a lot of very, very positive things that I think allow people, well, it's allowed the library to meet this vision of really being one big library that can serve everybody, but can serve everybody in still a very personal way. And that's a huge legacy and something that I hope that we never lose.
Last year, Mid-Continent Public Library the National Medal Award from the Institute of Museum and Library Services. I think I said that right. Mm-hmm. And this was pretty significant. You got to go to the White House, meet First Lady Michelle Obama, several different libraries or music organizations. One, we were one of them. Pretty big deal for us. Can you kind of just, you know, talk about that significant, the significance of that and what it means for us as a system and what it means for you, what it means for the staff, because it was, and how that came about, how we received that award and what went into that selection process too.
Well, it was truly an honor just to be nominated. No, that's what they tell you to say whenever you win something like that. But it was something that I felt it was an opportunity for us to sort of take a little test and see where we are as an organization to see if we really are among the top libraries in the United States. And to be completely honest, I mean, I talk Jim Staley and Diana Ryder helped a lot with the writing of the application and moving that idea forward. And I went and talked to them about it, and they looked at it initially, and they said, I don't know if we're ready. And I said, yeah, I kind of think we are. I said, let's try it and see what happens. And my real thought was that we wouldn't win. Honestly, didn't think that we were good enough to win it. I thought we were good enough to be a finalist maybe, but I didn't think we were good enough to win. And then what I figured is we'd learn a little bit, we'd add to our resume, and then we'd win it this year on our 50th anniversary, which would be really cool. Little did I know, you know. And when I talked with Susan Hildreth, she's no longer, but she was the director of the IMLS last year. She said, no, Mid-Continent. She said, you guys are way above the curve. I mean, she said, you guys are doing everything right. She said, the thing that you haven't done is ask for recognition. You guys just never, I mean, she said, you guys would have been a shoe-in 5 years ago if you guys would have put in for it. She said, but you were clearly a shoe-in this year. She said, it wasn't an issue at all. And so it was really important. The reason that I wanted to be awarded this in 2015 instead of 2014 was that I thought it was going to be really important for us in terms of sort of a culmination of our first 50 years, that we could look at all these great things that we've done over the last several years that the previous sort of 45 years had built up to, and that we could really say, yeah, you know, we have really arrived, that 50 years ago, we were a bunch of little tiny libraries in rented storefronts, some city libraries, some county libraries, and now we are recognized as one of the best libraries in the country. I thought that's what was going to be said this year. It was said last year, which was a really, really pleasant surprise.
Sorry, your plans were ruined.
Yeah, bummer.
Perfect scenario.
But I think it worked out really well, because part of what it allowed us to do is it allowed us to start having conversations with people about who we are leading into the 50th anniversary, mm-hmm. which became really popular. And I don't know about everybody in the organization, but the one thing that I can tell you is that as soon as we were nominated, as soon as we were a finalist, people became interested and they started talking to me about, you know, the library and, hey, what is this thing? And it gave me a brand new opportunity to have conversations with people that I hadn't had conversations with for a while about the library. And I'd like to divert just a second and talk about that point. Since I became the library director, I've been working, you know, I've been pursuing various accolades and various recognitions that my predecessors didn't. In the history of Mid-Continent, if you go back over time, Mid-Continent won a John Cotton Dana Award in the 1960s. John Ferguson was named Librarian of the Year in 1991, I believe it was. And a lot of us who were around, I mean, believe me, he more than deserved it. But the real motivation for nominating him was because Dan Bradbury from Kansas City Public had just won it the year before. And so there was a...
I looked that up.
Yeah, there was a competition.
So I found that interesting that nationally it was two local librarians back to back like that.
Yeah, it was really just sort of this unhealthy competition that we used to have back in those days that was fostering that. Not to say that both weren't very much deserving of the recognition. Both were, no doubt about it. It's just the motivation was the only thing that was kind of questionable. But that was really it for really the longest time, except for the odd local award of some sort. And when I became library director, I started focusing on these things. I mean, we won several impact awards from the Kansas City Business Journal. Won a John Cotton Dana Award again. We started winning all of these sorts of accolades and recognition, the National Medal. This is public. I don't think press releases have gone out, but it's public consumption. Mid-Continent Public Library will be the Truman Hartland Community Foundation Corporate Citizen of the Year for 2015. And that award will happen in September of this year. And to me, in a way, that's almost a bigger award than the National Medal, because for us to be recognized as a great library in the field of libraries is a really great thing, but it's what we're supposed to do. For the Community Foundation to look at us and say, you are among the great citizens of our community, you know, and that's all the citizens of all different types and all the different, and we're in the corporate citizen category. That's all the different corporate citizens. So that's going to include Hallmark. That's going to include Sprint. That's going to include everybody. That means a lot. It means that means we're connecting with our community in a very, very positive way. It won't involve going to the White House, but it means a lot. And so the reason that I've been pursuing these accolades is not because I have some sort of a need to have my ego stroked all the time about how great our library is. It really is the opportunity to have the conversation. As long as we are keeping ourselves front and center in our community, either through organizations like Truman Heartland or the IMLS or Kansas City Business Journal or any number of different organizations, it provides an opportunity for us to talk with people and have a conversation about what the library is doing and why the library is important to your community. Because we're an independent political subdivision, we're not a division of the city or the county. Sometimes we just get forgotten. I mean, it's just easy to forget about us because we're sort of off here on our own. And so if we don't jump up and down every so often and say, hey, remember us, remember we're awesome, then sometimes people forget us. And so that's why I am very excited about pursuing awards and recognition like this, not for any other reason, but to have good conversations with people about who our library is and why our library matters in the community. And really coming full circle, that's what the IMLS Award was about. It was about connecting, it is about recognizing how we connect with the community. And if you look back at not just the application, but what we were recognized for things like the Veterans Salute, which was us connecting with, and we've done for 16 years, that we've been connecting veterans with a larger community and a community of veterans and the services that they need and all the different things that goes along with that. We were nominated for a lot of different initiatives that we do, but most of them were around the communities that we serve and why those communities are important. So the IMLS Award was great, and I was glad that we did it. And it's really fun to be able to go to the White House at a time when they let you sit on the furniture, because you can at a situation like that, that you can go into every room you want to on the ground floor without people sort of, walking you around. You can walk on the carpet. It really was a great event and really very fun to be able to do. My big hope is that in a decade or so, after we've moved forward with some of our newer initiatives like the Story Center and like our small business initiatives and things like that, that we'll have an opportunity to go back again and be recognized as a sustaining great library in the United States.